This is an example of speech.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a no strings attached and no additional charges, off the cuff and from the hip, lighthearted yet exasperated, educated yet speculative, weekly conversational podcast in which we tell you what to think about politics, global affairs, current events, music, social media, culture, and anything else that bubbles up from the unlocked and unhinged comment threads in our brains. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter, at GlotinNemesis, and I have with me always and forever Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is W-Y-R-D. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Week Thoughts, The Return of the Twitterocracy, a review of Michael Wolff's book Fire and Fury, and much more. Prepare yourself to get riled up and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. And place your wealth in the hands of a few. The third world's washing guns and drugs,
financing the lives of the classless thugs, fighting over against the... All right. Welcome to Tell Me What You Think. Tell Me What to Think, sorry. My mind's being rotted away by Twitter, I'm sure. This is Week Thoughts. I would like to begin with a thought exercise, Charles. What's the worst news this morning? That the government's warning us how to be safe in a nuclear detonation through the CDC, or that Joe Arpaio is running for Senate?
I hadn't even heard the second part. What?
Yes. He just announced he's running for Senate probably an hour or two ago.
Is that supposed to be bad news?
On some measure, it's bad news. I think the thing is that he's running for Jeff Flake's seat, right? Because Jeff Flake is not rerunning again. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason Jeff Flake is not running is because there's a radical Republican challenger, a Bannonite, so to speak, that Flake was nervous about running against.
Yeah, that's not what Flake is nervous about, but okay.
Well, he didn't think he could win a primary, isn't that part of it? Or you just think he thought he couldn't win a general?
He couldn't win a general. I mean, you don't talk about the enemy you're scared of.
Hmm. Yeah.
And if anything, that was just free advertising for his, the guy who would have been his primary candidate, potentially giving him a political bump.
Sure.
But no, he's scared because of Arizona's shifting demographics. Like, that whole state is set up for legalization, and if it hadn't happened, like, what was that, last year they had the vote? They're just itching for it. The state is getting younger and more progressive because it's trying to draw, like, younger people to work there, and they're starting to have families and raise kids and have concerns about property taxes and social welfare networks.
Gasp. I agree with you. I don't think Joe Arpaio has much of a shot. I do think that the tenor of political discourse will be brought down a notch just by his mere existence as a candidate somewhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's going to split the Republican ticket and show how ineffectual and weak Steve Bannon is in electoral politics.
I don't know who he's going to back. The person he already sort of propped up or the... Or this new Joe? God damn it! All right.
It's interesting because it's like the Trump brand is splitting somewhat, and people are trying to grasp at different parts of it, and they're falling all over themselves to be more Trump than the next guy.
Yeah, and actually, all that 2017 showed is that in actual elections, if you're not Trump, it doesn't seem to work anyway.
Nope, doesn't matter. You don't have his personal charisma or his personal brand of being an outsider, I guess. I mean, again, he's no outsider considering he went to Wharton and is an East Coast elite, but whatever.
You're referring to the best colleges, I believe. Those are all of the best colleges. Because he's like smart, you know.
Right, and really smart and super stable.
Yes. So
But the good news, I think, from this week is that North Korea and South Korea are actually sitting down and having discussions, like practical discussions about how they're going to run the Olympic Games and how the North can help cooperate with them.
Yes, right? Absolutely. Yeah, that was inspiring, and
it's great that you have loud, belligerent strongmen trying to talk over you to really fucking be like, hey, man, this is obviously not about us. Let's sit down and talk about stuff that is about us.
See, but my really cynical take is that the administration, well, the president, because who the fuck knows about what the administration thinks or does, which we'll get to later as we talk about Michael Wolff's book. The president, I don't think, he doesn't get anything out of that.
Nope.
All he gets is there not being a nuclear bomb shot at America.
Needs that. He's been pushing for it. Well, at least maybe not the actual bombing, of course, but the threat of it, because he needs something to react against, or else he's a vacant and empty little man.
Yep, he needs an enemy. He needs someone to be, you know, fighting against.
I mean, he could make sure Rosie O'Donnell gets elected just to have somebody to fight with every day.
Yeah, or, you know, I mean, he'll just keep chalking up everything to Hillary Clinton for as long as he's still there. God, and probably long after he's gone.
She's just not president, dude. You are. What are you talking about?
Yeah. No, the Korean situation was surprisingly good news to hear. I mean, it's not, you don't, I'm so unaccustomed to hearing good things about people having diplomatic talks, you know, that have been mortal enemies for a long time, that, it was lovely.
I mean, it was kind of preceded because I don't know, obviously most people don't pay attention to this, but every time Kim has ever talked in public, especially before the People's Congress before, he's been wearing a work uniform. And this year, during his New Year's address, he wore an international business, like a business suit and tie.
Oh, so he's not, in reference to our title of last week's episode, he's not doubling down on crazy then.
No, he realizes that it's going to get him absolutely nothing. People are already running across the DMZ to defect, and it won't get any better.
And I think, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but maybe... God, I hate to say this in a weird way, but maybe Trump's craziness helped in that he's like, oh, maybe, you know, Kim, oh, maybe crazy isn't the right tactic. Maybe now's the time to be respectable.
Well, the thing about Kim is that he's always trying to be a counterpoint. Like, in the time of the very upbraided and respectable Obama, he was trying to be crazy man, but now that there is another crazy man, he can be the up-buttoned and respectable one and actually maybe get North Korea back into the international community in any significant way.
Man, wouldn't that be something?
Right? I mean, way to go, Donald, I guess. I mean, don't take credit for it.
But... yeah, it's more of like a butterfly effect type credit. Like, it's not really... him actively pursuing an agenda with any sort of logical coherence, and then that agenda bearing fruit. It's more like he knocked down, he inadvertently stumbled into a domino that happened to lead to some good change.
Right, because Kim Jong-un is a way more strategic thinker than Donald J. Trump. All right, what else is going on in the news today?
What else is...
I mean, obviously, my thoughts are with Erica Garner. Her visitation was yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Long lines of people out the door, of course. Probably halfway to the ferry.
Tell some of our listeners about Erica Garner and her her role over the past few years.
Erica Garner was someone who... I don't think she ever really wanted to be famous, but... mm-mm. She was Eric Gardner's daughter, and in the wake of his death, really, what's the word, stepped up to the plate? Like, she didn't stand or turn away from the media's glare, but had the intellectual and moral fortitude to, you know, call an ace and recognize what was happening was wrong, and actually work against it in whatever way that she could.
And Eric Garner was brutally slain by
New York police. The famous phrase he muttered before he died was, "I can't breathe," and as they proceeded to choke him to death.
And how did she pass away?
She had an enlarged heart and an asthma attack that she had triggered a heart attack, which left her in a coma and brain dead.
It's terrible.
Yeah. She has two children, a family, obviously other brothers and sisters, and other family out in New York. So, but it's genuinely terrible, because I can't think of anybody else who has her kind of just wisdom. I mean, independent of her background, she was willing to say what needed to be said, even though she gained nothing off of it. If anything, it just destroyed her life in pretty significant ways.
It's another thing you don't see much of as much today, it seems.
Citizen activism?
Well, yeah, but even just selfless activism.
Right.
I mean, obviously there are activists out there who are selfless, but, you know, it doesn't seem as prominent or as newsworthy as it maybe once was.
And Joe Arpaio is going to run for Senate, though. But yeah, my thoughts go out with Erica Gardner and all of her family.
Yeah, what else has been going on in the news?
The town of Beloit is about to file incorporation papers.
To be the city of Beloit? Is that
to be
taken?
The city of Riverside, I think is what they want to call themselves, or the village of Riverside.
Okay. How is it a large enough? Is there logistical reason they're doing this, or they've just gotten so big? It's necessary?
Demographic reasons. There's no real reason they need to do it. They just kind of want to do it so they can have a separate tax base and probably restrict who goes into what was now the town of Beloit School District, because I think with the voucher system and the way Wisconsin education works, people from the city can go out to what is Beloit Turner in the township to go to school, where, shall we say, the demographics are different.
Yeah, that. For those that don't know,
Beloit is a heavily segregated city. Actually, almost all of our major urban areas are similarly segregated, and it's just Beloit and Milwaukee are almost the worst and most... Well, Beloit, Milwaukee, and Racine are the worst and most egregious examples, because Racine is just as bad.
Yeah, and for those who don't know that, and I'm sure this happens elsewhere, but you know, kids get moved around by their parents because they don't like. When we just had someone move away from across the street here, who I hope doesn't listen to this podcast, and another neighbor was like, "We're like, oh, why are they moving?" And someone's like, "Oh, she said she doesn't really like the school that much because they're moving into a new school district now." And someone who may have had a drink or two was like, there's too many black kids here. I'm like, ooh, really?
You live in a pretty well-integrated neighborhood, actually.
Yes, and I love that about the school. Like, I mean, I'm sure it's predominantly white, but there are many kids of all walks of life at that school.
Which is great.
Yeah, I mean, Hispanic, South Asian, Middle Eastern, East Asian,
probably
African-American. Yep. I mean, it's very inclusive. It's just an area of the city that's like that. I think because it's a relatively nice, safe, but it's not...
overpriced.
It's, yeah, and it's lower middle class to middle class. Actually, speaking of Wisconsin schools, too, our beloved Governor Walker kind of had a little flip-flop this week, as far as I understand, where he's now going to be backing a plan to allow rural school districts to raise property taxes without a referendum. to slightly raise property taxes without a referendum so as to fund their schools more.
Huh, that's interesting.
Which is something that's had some bipartisan support, probably more Republican support just because in Wisconsin more rural areas are Republican. Hmm. But nonetheless, bipartisan support in the legislature, and I believe he vetoed a bill last session that was very, very similar, although his spokesman pointed out a small difference that apparently made all the difference. And, you know, the Democrats, you know, this is something that I have mixed feelings about. Many Democrats, if not most or all of them, would support this. But they have to make sure to call out the governor as doing this for political reasons because it's an election year, which is probably true. It makes me feel inside like, can't we just say good job?
I feel like the fact that he has to do this should be even a bigger indictment on him, because school funding has been his little whipping boy for the entire time he's been Wisconsin governor. I mean, Act 10 was pretty much aimed at teachers' unions, and his subsequent budgets have been all about starving the state and starving the beast, but the biggest part of Wisconsin spending is our education system, which he, again, loves kicking, but apparently he's kicked it too much, so he has to offer it a bit of food so it'll stand up so he can kick it again. Sorry.
Which I, not in those words, but I heard brought up by a Democrat quoted in the article as like, well, this wouldn't have been necessary without his complete mismanagement of the schools in his administration. Pardon me. That may have even been brought up by Tony Evers, who's running for
governor.
We
could talk about that. There's like 17 people trying to run for governor now.
Our mayor in Madison here, my mayor, Paul Soglin, longtime institution in the city of Madison, also an old man, is running for governor. Malon Mitchell is relatively prominent. He's running for governor. He is the head of the state firefighters union? I don't know if it's a city or state union.
I think it's a state union.
I think it is too. And
one of the only unions to stand against Act 10 too, even though it didn't really affect them.
Yep, them and the police were exempted, and
the police didn't march.
No, but the police, I would argue, had a fairly hands-off policy during those protests. I am sure there were people behind the scenes telling them to be more aggressive. The most part, they were fairly kind.
I mean, they were just accommodating, because if they did anything else, they would have just gotten hit with so many expensive lawsuits. It would have been just a huge waste of their time.
Yeah, but that
and if they had done what the governor did, well, I mean, but if they did it in a huge organized fashion, and like when the entire world was looking at Wisconsin,
yeah.
That would have just ruined their political capital.
Yeah. And on an individual level, having been down there during those protests, the cops were generally supportive as well. But you're right, organizationally, they didn't do anything. The firefighters definitely did. Malon Mitchell did. I was right there standing right next to the entrance of the Capitol when Malon Mitchell led a procession of firefighters, Jesse Jackson and Tammy Baldwin, in there. Into march into the Capitol, where everyone was, drum circling and stuff.
Yeah, I was there with you that day.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know. I mean, I remember seeing him. I was like, oh, this guy. I don't know if he has a lot of oomph behind his campaign. I don't know that anyone does right now. Tony Evers might be the most prominent at the moment, or Soglin.
I think Soglin has more of name recognition only because he's been Madison's mayor like three times. Jesus.
Yeah, I don't know what that gives you across the state, though.
Hmm. Well, in a blue wave year.
Yeah, that's good. I think that's his main calculation. He's like, if I could win this primary, which he very well might if he has the city of Madison and our Democratic bloc behind him, he could maybe ride the wave to the governorship. And
yeah, right. Let's kick him upstairs and get him out of Madison so we can quit ruining my beloved city.
And, yeah, fail upwards. I'll say this about him. He has a long history. He actually has taught public policy before, which is the very least a refreshing thing for a governor to have on their resume.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, he's – I don't know. I don't think he's great. I don't think he's terrible.
I disagree with how they're developing Madison, but that's because I appreciated the small-town feel of the Isthmus when we were going to college there.
Yeah, and there is a very potent political subsect in Madison that is resistant to development like that, and they have been wiped out pretty much in the past 5 to 10 years. I have mixed feelings. I think some of it's a realization that it's going to happen, and you know, you can't fight the population increase and the businesses wanting to come here because of essentially the built-in education and governmental base, both human resources wise and monetary, you know, just straight up money coming into the city. That's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And the area is growing. Epic is growing down in Verona, which a lot of people live in the city. So, I mean, yeah, it just depends as how you're going to develop it, where you're going to develop it. I don't think they need to develop for the sake of attracting people, which I think they do.
Which is, yeah, kind of my point. They're just building these huge high rises, expecting people to be in them. And it's like, for one, why does it have to be downtown? I mean, yeah. I get that it has to have some kind of proximity to the centers of power, but Epic seems to be making a good go of it despite being like 30 miles away.
Yeah, but a lot of the people who live downtown are people who work at Epic. Anecdotally, my dad had a friend from Atlanta, and his daughter got a job at Epic right out of school. She was a math major. So she's moving to Madison. So my dad's like, well, you know, I like seeing you guys, so I'll help you move in. So he's there, and she's like, you know, she's 22, 23, you know, a young person, likes to meet other young people that she's moving in with, almost like a college dorm type feel. So she's going up and introducing herself, and people are saying hi to her who are moving in that same day, that same weekend. Every single person was a young person being hired to work at Epic. This was the first day that the building opened. It was a brand new high rise down there.
Wow. Well, and there is demand, I guess.
Yeah. I do sort of agree with you, though. Why does it have to be downtown? It still seems like Soglin has this whole thing about revitalizing East Wash, because when people come in, it should be nice. And yeah, there's a lot of wasted space over there, and I think it should be more wisely used. But who are we trying to impress here?
Like, yeah,
people are coming here anyways. We don't need to attract people. Mm-hmm. And maybe the quaintness of the downtown would have been an attraction. But that's
why people come to Madison. At least it was when we were going there.
Yeah.
I'll state an argument that I stated to a guy, a random group of people in a hot tub in Colorado about this. It's because I was talking to a guy from St. Louis about how Madison is developing. It's Madison before was a city about how much they loved each other, right? The hippies,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily wealthy people who really tried to look out for themselves and their community and their neighborhood and everything else around them. But if you push the people who don't love each other or who love each other out, you get the people who don't love each other, and then you get those kinds of problems. It turns into, oh gosh, this fucking hippie drum circle or this marathon is occupying the entire downtown all weekend. Well, I guess we can't drive anywhere. To, oh my god, there was another shooting on State Street.
And I mean, there's violence. There's way more violence downtown lately than when we were in school and living down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's It's an interesting...
The school's still there. The capital's still there. What changed? The city around it.
Yep. Yeah, it's... They could have done other ways. And, hey, one other thing I want to bring up is related to all this is... So as the city is doing whatever they are doing, whatever their motivations are to develop, the state is hindering our infrastructure at the same time, during the same time period, by Walker, when he first came to be governor, vetoing the train line that the government was almost entirely going to pay for, the federal government.
Yeah, right. It would have just been convenient.
He would have had like $7 million a year in repair costs, I think was the estimate.
But that would have been, anyways, yeah.
But I mean,
it would have been balanced out by sales taxes and other improvements.
Yeah. And now they are dragging their feet on our Beltline, which is woefully inadequate. For those that don't know who aren't in Wisconsin, the Beltline is a state highway that circumvents our city by going around downtown, which, if you look at a map of Madison, is an isthmus with a lake north and south of it. And this kind of goes south of the southern lake, right, around the majority of the city, although I actually live south of it.
But it's, I think you meant circumnavigate instead of circumvent.
Circumnavigate, sorry. And it's just like hell on rush hours. It's stop and go. It also has, I believe, overall, I think it's like twice the accident rate of other state highways in the state, and certain sections of it are 2-3 times or 3-4 times.
Around certain exits.
Yeah.
Like Fish Hatch and Park.
And it's just, I've almost gotten into accidents there. It's just not a good situation. And the state has been for years working on some sort of development plan, which they just recently stopped funding that. And this is all while they're expediting
the 3-lane change in I-90, for instance.
And the just like over the course of a couple of weeks, they're about to start expanding around Foxconn in Racine County. That's like overnight, they're all of a sudden able to do that. And they have the money for it, and everything's fine. But they've, you know, there's been one significant thing on the Beltline in the past, since I've been here, 15 years.
That was the Park Street improvements, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Well,
those have been improved.
I'm referring to, so maybe it's been 10 years. But I'm referring to the west side with Verona Road, Gammon Road has been expanded. Right. They put in they redid the interchange. Mm-hmm. But even so, that's still actually a bottleneck, even with that.
They put it in another lane.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Well, enough complaining about our state. You want to come on back and talk about Fire and Fury?
Sure. I'm not all the way through it, but we can talk.
That's all right. 70% punditry is as good as anything else.
I mean, I can't believe other people are speaking on it who obviously haven't read it. So.
Oh, I know. Okay, yeah, let's come back and complain about that. Spread through the world, a new dominion as
old world powers rebuild. Billions for the past. Putting tonight, Southwest Floridians sharing some hot opinions on social media right now about that new behind-the-scenes book about the Trump presidency called Fire and Fury. President Trump calling the book, which just hit the shelves today, phony. Four New Corners Michael Cadigan heading to a local bookstore in Lee County to get your take. Michael.
Patrick, the book claims to take you inside President Trump's first year in the Oval Office. So I went outside a local bookstore to see if people planned on picking up a copy of Fire and Fury.
The book getting national attention, including readers in Lee County. Some researched it before it hit shelves.
I was interested, and I went and read some of the excerpts that were published, and they were interesting. They were certainly fun reading. How accurate it is? Probably not quite so.
Some say they'd read a copy.
Since it's in the media and so forth, I think it'd be interesting just to see what it's all about.
To go buy that new book that just came out about Trump.
But many say the book isn't for them.
I have no interest in buying the book. I don't think it's really factual.
Like a tabloid type book to me. I don't think I would be real interested. When they don't name their sources, it seems a little strange. I don't think I would care to read it.
I wouldn't support that book. I think there's a lot of propaganda, and it really is what it's all about.
But regardless, if you wanted a copy or not, Fire and Fury flew off the shelves today.
The lady told us about how, like, they weren't, they didn't have any more copies of the book, like, they're all sold out, and how they weren't, like, they just, everyone was buying it.
Last Friday, Michael Wolff came out with a book entitled Fire and Fury. Y'all may have heard of it. And it has taken the nation by storm, or at least the resistance, the liberal media.
Class.
Yeah. Of which we have a podcast, so we're kind of part of that now, you know?
I guess we are.
And it is a scandalous expose. It is a book that's trying to get you into the White House. It's not so much independent commentary on the White House, is at least what he was going for, the author.
Yeah, there are no charts or figures in it.
Yeah, and there's no it's certainly not from the perspective of a liberal establishment. I mean, it's not really commenting that much on policy.
No, it's about personalities and,
yeah.
I guess one thing I notice is he keeps trying to define people's attributes. Like, he'll go through these anecdotes and be like, for instance, one I remember clearly is cruelty is a Trump attribute.
Yeah, and he, in his interviews on the book, Michael Wolff repeatedly claims that he's giving you other people in the White House's perspective on each other, essentially. It's hard to parse out as you're reading the book what kind of, when you see lines like that that aren't a quote or from the perspective of a specific person, you know, is that his interpretation of things? Is that the people around Trump's interpretation of things? Does that matter? I mean, are we surprised that Trump seems cruel?
No, he's obviously made a career out of it, but
it's
interesting that we can see the, the examples of it up close.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, the chewing people out, and it seems to even, there's one point in the book, I don't know if it's one that you got to, where Bannon just, he chews out Hope Hicks so much that she runs from the room crying, and a formal complaint with, like, their equivalent of their HR department is filed against Bannon.
Holy cow.
For like, verbal abuse, essentially.
Wait, is that different from the time that Trump made her run out of the room for calling her the best piece of ass that Corey Lewandowski will ever have in his life?
That is different from that part, correct.
Oh, okay.
I assume it's a different kind of cry that she was
having.
Poor
Hope Hicks.
I know. Poor Hope Hicks. She seems the most of anyone there like she drank the Kool-Aid and is part of a cult.
Yeah.
She's constantly trying to please the president. And especially latter half of the book, blames her for enabling him more than anyone.
Yeah, it does really paint the picture of her as her being the one person who's up close to him all day, every day.
Yeah, she's Mr. Smithers. She's around him constantly saying, oh, yeah, that's great. Or,
and feeding him news.
Yep. Feeding him the news that'll make him happy. It's a sad... I think someone actually makes this metaphor in the book, but it's like the movie Sunset Boulevard. He's this lonely, formerly great person. It's just that he happens to be in the White House and not a rundown Hollywood mansion.
No, he has a place in Hollywood.
Well, yeah, okay. I think Beverly Hills is what they said in the... I heard Wolf say in an interview, because he went to go talk... That's how the book came about, is he went to go talk with Trump at a Beverly Hills mansion of his.
Interesting.
Because Trump liked the cover of an article that Wolf wrote last summer, I believe, about Trump, which was fairly critical of him, but Trump liked the graphics, so.
Well, he doesn't read, so.
Yep, well, which they also get into in the book, his semi-literacy, as some call it. Apparently, some of the people Wolf interviewed pushed back on that fact by saying, well, he can read the headlines about him. He's not illiterate. He can read the headlines, which,
wow,
technically does mean he can read some. That is true.
I guess that makes him semi-literate.
Yeah, that's that. It's the semi part. Exactly. So what's your take on the, for anyone who's been not in a cave the past week, we've all heard, some of the juicy bits that have come out, Bannon saying it's treasonous, that for sure Trump knew about the Don Jr. Trump Tower meeting. It gets a lot into Kushner and Bannon and Priebus fighting.
Jarvanka.
And Jarvanka, which is a term I just read way too much over the past 4 days. If I don't see Bannon or Jarvanka in print for a few days, I'll be happy. I just need to not see that every 4 words. But also, there have been a lot of this is what we talked about in the last segment or started to get into. There have been a lot of takes on this book of people I'm pretty sure have not read it. People were talking about the journalistic accuracy of the book before it came out.
It's not a piece of journalism.
Well, Wolf would say it is, though. He said he had the journalistic standards. He met all these journalistic standards, which is, I'm sure, debatable.
Admirable.
Yeah. I think the best defense I heard him make, though, which is I think I was making over the weekend when we were talking. I think it was with you as we were gaming. But is unlike the White House reporters who have to put out a story every day, every 2 days, every week, and then they have to go back, talk to their sources, get more interviews because they're still on the job. Michael Wolf just sat there, didn't report on anything for, 9 months or so?
Yeah, just and, fly on the wall.
And then dropped a book, and he's not going back. He's not accountable in a social sense to them. And I think that's what's maybe even upsetting some of the White House press corps.
Is that he's not willing to play the access journalism game?
Well, he doesn't have to. Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah, he, which, and in this interview where he made that point, he was very complimentary of them. And he's like, I get why they have to do that. They can only say so much, which, right, by the way, they have said a lot of these terrible things. But they have to be careful and particular about it.
Right, because they represent huge organizations, which many organizations need that relationship.
Yeah, on top of the individual reporters, exactly.
But he could just walk in there and throw all the bombs he needed to.
Yeah, and some people are calling him a weasel, which I'm like, well, sometimes it takes a weasel to get into the hen house. I mean, that doesn't mean that he's wrong just because he's a slime bag.
Right? Who's going to inform on the happenings at the garbage dump? You're not going to get anybody clean. You're going to need the cockroach to drop dime.
Exactly. I think that a lot of the criticism has been maybe true, but missing the point.
Yeah, I assume that almost nobody in the Republican leadership who spent the weekend on their talking points has even opened the book, but yeah.
Oh, I disagree with that. I guarantee they opened the book. They read it and they ate it up. But that doesn't mean they're going to say something negative about the president once they're in front of a camera or a microphone.
Yeah, it is an interesting personality study into Donald Trump and who he kind of is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
it really lets you see him.
It does not paint a flattering picture. I think I could probably count on one hand the number of, in a roundabout way, nice things said about him in the book. There seemed to be early on in the administration and late in the campaign a little bit of awe about him. You know, like, you know, he has a lot of energy. He's very he can be very personable and complimentary to people.
Charismatic,
and,
even.
Mm-hmm. And, hey, he won. There must be something to him.
Well, he's a salesman.
Yeah, he's a Dale Carnegie type protege.
But to just talk about your last point about how there were very few compliments, which is really telling, because as we pointed out, this book is almost entirely based on what people say, the people around him say about him, and they're not even willing to give him a compliment.
Which I could see being in the heat of the moment. Maybe, you know, maybe Sean Spicer does have a lot nice to say about Trump. But while he was working there, that wasn't at the forefront of his mind. It actually, a big part of the book is organization.
Or the lack of it.
Exactly. It's kind of, if I had to try and boil it down to one main thesis, is that it was chaos, it was disorganized, and it was poorly run.
Right, it isn't even Bannon and Trump's brand of organized chaos, which they seem to try to flourish in.
Particularly Bannon. He views it, the White House as like a tent propped up in a war zone. And, you know, we have to hit them hard and fast. And we have to make quick plans, think on the spot. You know, and Ivanka and Jared just wanted business as usual. They consistently in the book are pushing for whatever was normally done, we should do.
Right, because they're kind of centrists, almost Democrats in some respects.
Yeah, except for actual policy. Like you don't hear about in the book, and I haven't heard them publicly beyond one or two like semi-feminist things, Ivanka says, proposing many liberal things. No. But I think the book calls them Wall Street Democrats, which might be a little fair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But to point out, like, the problem with Bannon is that if he had just, like, he was appointed campaign manager or the CEO of the campaign in August when the Mercers stepped in and put a bunch of money in it. If he had just spent even some fraction of those three to 6 months before the inauguration just planning anything, he would have been on such a more solid footing against all of his, basically opponents in the White House, because they didn't have a plank to stand on. All Bannon had was his nebulous ideas about Trumpism that he had no idea how he was going to actually implement on the very first day of the administration.
Yeah, if he would have hired, because, I mean, that's normal for a major presidential campaign.
I don't know about that. Obama had his policy pretty much, well, not exactly.
Sorry, I meant to say the opposite of what I just said.
Oh, okay.
That's not normal for a presidential campaign. It's Hillary, Obama, yeah, they would have had, and I'm sure their opponents too. I'm sure Romney, McCain had people working on the transition before the transition starts.
Right, and that's what Christie was going to be doing, but they didn't think they were going to win, so they didn't give him the time of day.
Yeah.
But again, if just fucking Bannon had done that shit on his own, he would have been able to stomp out everybody else. Because it's all well and good to set up a tent in front of the old, like, government building, but if you don't move beyond the tent, then the government building, or the people in the government building, are just going to push you out. I just want to say I really don't like Bannon or anything about him. I'm just...
I mean, it's kind of like, well, thank God he didn't.
Right.
Imagine all the shit that he's probably had bubbling in his mind for the past decade, that if he would have had the wherewithal to actually get people in who could write executive orders, who knew how to push legislation. They exist. I mean, for as much trouble as this White House has had hiring people and finding people to work with them, one passage in the book talks about 9 DC law firms turned them down to be their defense in the Russian inquiry. For as much trouble as they've had, there are people exist who exist right out there who will
somebody
do it.
Funds Grover Norquist.
Yeah, I'm sure the Mercers, if they would have been working on it, could have thrown out some healthy salaries for a think tank to start prepping more.
Right, instead of just playing politics. But that's, I guess, the problem with Bannon is he was always in these fights, which half of them are only in his own mind.
Yeah, yep. And you certainly do not have a president who has any experience actually organizing and planning and running staffs. He just doesn't. He ran a family business that apparently wasn't even that big.
Yeah, and his staff was his family for the most part.
Yeah, which is why he just wanted to bring them in to the White House. Or a few close confidants.
Mm-hmm. Stone.
Oh, yeah, he wanted to have Tom... is it Barack? Tom Barack? Tom Barrack? Yeah. I don't know how to pronounce that name.
Yeah, I already said Barack, because it looks like Barack Obama. And maybe that's a... to call Donald Trump's best friend Barack might be...
Oh, God. Make him red in the face. No, that guy is someone who ran with Trump and Jeffrey Epstein, I believe, back in the 80s, getting into all types of trouble, I'm sure. And Trump, this is one of the few people brought up in the book that Trump really looks up to, really respects. This guy ran the inaugural committee and raised funds for the inauguration. And
somehow.
Yeah. And Trump wanted him to be chief of staff. And the guy's like, no, I can't do that. I'm just too rich. He couldn't divest from all of his fortune, and he didn't want anyone looking in ethically to his fortune. So he turned it down. But he apparently, and a few other people, would talk to Trump regularly every night. And I assume that's still happening, that part.
Yeah, his billionaire's cabinet that he keeps talking to every night.
Yeah. Rupert Murdoch and...
Man, it really makes me realize how much I need to get out more. That guy has, like, virtually no personable contact.
Yeah. Well,
other than
so,
Hopix.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to the isolated billionaire trope.
Mm-hmm.
He has his yes men or women, and he doesn't really know how to operate outside of that. And that's why he likes them fighting amongst each other. That's another. I mean, that's in terms of the plot of the book, the majority of it is infighting, almost entirely.
It's Bannon and Kushner fighting it out with Trump. Just lobbing grenades occasionally between them to give him something to argue over.
One thought I had is, so there's one passage early in the book where he lays out the three factions. There's Reince Priebus, who is the Republican establishment. There's Bannon, who's the kind of militant alt-right. And then there's Kushner, who's represents, I guess, the Wall Street Democrats, although...
The money.
Yeah, he just represents other billionaires. And, that may or may not be Republican or Democrat. And anyway, so they, they're constantly battling it out. And the interesting thing I took away from this is that Jared and Ivanka are now the last ones standing. Bannon's out, Reince is out. But in the end, I see it more as Jared took on the Republican, along with, just Trump himself, I'm sure, took on the Republican establishment, and the Republican establishment faction essentially is the winner. Because that's
you
what
think?
Trump... Yeah, that's his... I just read here in a... online, just a second ago, Trump is going to Davos, which keeps getting brought up in the
book.
Are
you kidding me?
I didn't even actually know what that was, but it's a World Economic Forum, I guess.
Yeah, it's a place where the world's wealthiest and most powerful every year gather to talk about how they're, quote, going to make the world a better place.
Yeah, and so Trump just wants that suck up to that adulation.
Well, fucking, I'm sorry, I really need to stop swearing, but Xi Jinping went last year for the first time ever.
Oh, okay.
So he's still trying to compare. It's still a petty personal competition for him.
That's an interesting little section of the book, too. A little bit of the kind of personal insight behind the foreign policy of the White House, which is that Trump kept calling Xi Jinping Mr. XI or XE or whatever. Yeah. And he had to be told, no, it's like a woman. Just call him Mr. Xi.
Yeah, that's so terrible, right?
So most
White Houses have, like, entire foreign policy establishments. Like, they have, like, their own staff in the White House, like, on the NS as part of the National Security Council. And then that coordinates with, like, the various parts of the government that do foreign policy, like USAID, the State Department, the Defense Department. In broad strokes.
Yeah. No, I mean... Trump has Jared and a bunch of people he doesn't want to listen to, who he finds boring or sarcastically calls them geniuses.
Professors was, I think, his favorite derogatory word.
Yeah, he like can't sit through PowerPoints that McMaster gives him. And he hires these people and then immediately starts hating them.
Yeah, they're there just for appearances almost.
He hires McMaster, and then he doesn't like McMaster, and he thinks he should fire him. He hires John Kelly, and a day later, he's regretting hiring John Kelly, or moving him to chief of staff, I guess. But to get back to the foreign policy side, it's, I think based on the content of this podcast that we've gotten into over the past couple months, I found it particularly interesting, the bit about MBS.
I was just reading that before we got on.
From Saudi Arabia, bin Salam. And
Mohammed bin Salman.
Salman. And he, Trump believes that he engineered a coup there.
Wow.
Is what he apparently was going around the White House saying. We got our guy in we put our guy on top there.
Yeah, I heard that, and I didn't... That's disgusting. In reality, your guy was the guy, Prince Nayef, or Bin Nayef, who he kicked out. That guy was a U.S. ally and had been since the invasion of Iraq.
But maybe this guy's now a Trump ally, which is more what he cares about.
I suppose.
There is no long-term thinking here.
No, absolutely not.
There is very short-term, immediate gain, which is what they seem to be looking at. How did you like the book in terms of just reading it?
As someone who edits text a lot, it was kind of nerve-wracking, especially at the beginning parts that weren't edited very well in terms of copy.
Yeah.
Because there were so many verbs that were just, left out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became a little difficult to follow at points, but I like the flow of it. I mean, it does kind of jump around in time, but it jumps around in terms of topic rather than chronological order, which is interesting and helps you really see how schizophrenic that guy's decision-making process is.
I actually agree. To me, it reads like a pop history book a little bit, even though it's a contemporaneous current events.
Yeah, accounting.
It reminds me of, some history books I've read that kind of get you into the minds of the historical figures. It's just that this is getting you into the mind of someone here and now.
Right, who you can turn on the TV and see, or go look at his Twitter feed.
And then bash your head against a brick wall.
And then it might start to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I thought the flow of the book was good. It wasn't the best thing I've ever written, or I mean read, by any means. But I think it's worth a pickup. What I liked about it is that there wasn't a ton of completely new information. He didn't get a ton of scoops that the White House press corps hasn't already gotten out there before.
But he does provide the context that they are usually ignoring.
Exactly. He gives you a little bit of behind the scenes about how this leak got out.
Right. And how Sean Spicer had 5 minutes to react to James Comey being fired before he had a meeting with Howard Kurtz.
Yeah, or how Sean Spicer, within a minute of Scaramucci being made his boss, gave Trump his resignation letter.
Scaramucci.
The Scaramucci chapter was great. It was just, I actually missed a lot of that because I was on vacation that week. Not realizing
the whole
that
time
was,
he was in job. In the
yeah,
job.
That was 70% of his tenure. Was my week long vacation.
He burned too bright for the world to love.
Yes. But I think context is the great word. It gives, to me, a good context. Even actually, the bits about the Russian investigation, which I think were actually way too, giving too much credit to Trump and were not, fully taken into account
some of the context that's been later revealed.
Yeah, and the giant pile of evidence against Trump. But what it did do is give you an insight into their reaction to it, which I didn't know that much about.
I like the insight into Rod Rosenstein. How he?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, you put Trump up. Like, after Trump put you in an impossible position, you gave Trump Mueller. Funny.
Yeah, it was like Rosenstein would have his revenge, and it would only take a couple days.
Just a couple phone calls.
Yep. Yeah. No, yeah. That's to me, that's – we all know that Rosenstein named Mueller. We know that that Trump dictated this poor response to the revelation of the Trump Jr. Don Jr. Trump Tower meeting. But it paints this picture and it gives you a readable narrative for this all that I think people will be reading for a while now. The main question I now have after the book though is, how much of this is still exactly happening? I'm sure the president himself hasn't really changed. But
how much has John Kelly imposed? How much order has he imposed behind the scenes?
Yeah, and there's kind of two competing things going on that are different than the beginning of the White House. So one is, yes, John Kelly. Much more potent chief of staff than Priebus was. Instilled some measure, at least, of order, not necessarily on the president, but on the staff of the White House. They point out at the end of the book, actually, him going to a dinner that Jared and Ivanka were having with the president, and Jarvanka was taken aback by him being there, realizing that the reason he was there is to make sure they weren't talking about policy things with the president. The other difference in the White House now, he gets into a bit at the end of the book, is that the staff are not, for as inexperienced as the staff was, there was some measure of experience, maybe not in those types of jobs, but I mean, Spicer had been around in communications for a while, Bannon at least had been, editor of a publication for a while.
There's Priebus and his deputy chief of staff. I forget her name off the top.
Yeah, there are some Goldman Sachs people. Well, I guess a couple of them are still there. But
Tina Powell, Gary Cohn.
Mm-hmm. But the end of the book kind of gives you this notion that the two closest people, besides Jarvanka, to the president now are Hope Hicks, who's 28, and Stephen Miller, who we saw this past weekend on Jake Tapper is a complete fucking lunatic. And he now essentially has the job that Bannon had.
What, being provocateur in chief?
Well, I was going to say chief policy advisor, but yes. He's
Stephen Miller is the chief policy advisor to the President of the United States.
I think my favorite passage in the book is the first time they talk about Stephen Miller saying he was supposed to be a speechwriter, but he could only write in bullet points. He was supposed to be a policy advisor, but he had no knowledge of policy. I think there were even a couple more. But he has no discernible skills or abilities.
No, he was just an empty suit who thought, like, the exercise of power made you worthy of power.
Yeah, and he could grovel at the president's feet and tell him how clean
great
and
he was.
Great they are. Yeah.
Yeah, and how terrible, though, those Muslims are, apparently.
And the fake news is. Tell them how fake the fake news is.
Go on the news and yell at them about how they're fake for the benefit of the president's... Yeah.
Scream for 15 minutes about how you just want 3 minutes to tell your side.
Even though he's asking you to tell your side.
Jake Tapper is a saint. He had way more restraint than I would have had.
Yeah, I would have cut Stephen Miller off way sooner. It's like, okay, after the second question that you didn't answer and I asked, I'm not going to ask you anymore, and I'm not going to give you any more of my airtime. I can talk.
Yeah.
Like, Jake Tapper could have just talked into a camera to make up the time.
Yeah, and this notion that they are so disrespectful of the White House, the only reason he got those 15 minutes is because they are trying to be respectful to the White House, and maybe they do truly need to stop. I mean... I don't know.
What's the point of playing this access game if when they do give you access, it's to tell you how terrible you are and not give you any proper information or even insight into what they're thinking?
Are they just negging the CNN?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get them to like them through criticizing
exactly.
them?
Mm-hmm. Or get the people who watch CNN to like them because it's
I think that's up. I actually think that's it, is that... by any traditional objective measure, Stephen Miller lost that interview.
Oh, absolutely. But it'll play really well on conservative circles, because most of them are on YouTube instead of cable news, at least the ones that would look for Stephen Miller.
Yeah, and so if you are coming from a perspective that CNN just needs to be shouted down and told how great the president is, then that would be a win. And that's a minority of people, but it's a potential. It's a strong minority. It's a sizable minority.
At least 33%, right?
Yeah. I haven't seen his approval ratings in a couple weeks. I assume they're still sub 40 at most.
I mean, more. It's not like he's getting more people to like him. Can't imagine.
Well, the end of the year establishment push for the tax bill and like how great he is and all the things he accomplished. And, you know, that was until he started flying off the hook on, what was that, January 2nd?
Mm-hmm.
Before that, there was a strong week, 2 week push to make him seem like this great traditional Republican president. I think that's been mostly thrown out the window, though we'll see what the Congress does over the next month or so. Will give us a little bit more perspective on whether or not they're going to try and maintain that facade.
I mean, they kind of have to in order to advance their agenda.
Well, and he has to if he wants to get anything, like, quote-unquote, wins.
Right. Because it depends on them. Well, they're kind of in the same boat together. I'm not sure who's Pi and who's the tiger in this scenario. I think Paul Ryan might just be the bucket that they all shit in.
I've gotten the impression that McConnell talks to the president more than he was over the summer and before. I think Paul Ryan's actually in charge.
I'm not sure if that's comforting or terrifying.
Oh, it's well, yeah, compared to, yeah, whoever else in charge. Yeah, who knows nowadays. But, no, it's terrible. It's terrible. And I don't think it's going to bode well for them. Although, the more he seems like a respectable Republican president, the harder it will be for the Democrats.
And that respectability is just a facade. Oh, I've heard so many anecdotal accounts from people who have had to deal with them on a personal basis where if they, like, even respectfully offer the slightest bit of criticism, he accuses them of being obtuse and just shuts down the conversation.
Paul Ryan?
Yeah. He will not tolerate anybody who says that what he's saying isn't true and the best thing that they've ever heard.
Man.
He has no regard for anybody outside himself, either.
Except for the president, but that's only because the president will sign what he wants him to sign.
And that's still kind of selfish.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's fake. It's not really respecting the president. I don't honestly believe that Paul Ryan thinks any of these things he says about the president or there's any truth to the way he treats the president in public. But as long as the president will sign what he wants him to sign, as long as the president doesn't do anything too big without his personal approval, not even Congress's vote, without his personal and McConnell's personal approval, I think they're running things.
Yeah, really well, they've reduced government to personalities, so...
Yep.
That's what you get when you take out the filibuster and other legislative options that the minority voice had to express itself.
Yeah, and this is actually a narrative in the book, is that not so much McConnell, but he talks about as soon as Trump took power, Paul Ryan immediately stopped saying anything negative about Trump and went to the White House or called up the White House and kissed Trump's ass. All of a sudden, Trump now liked him and said, hey, let's just do whatever Paul Ryan wants.
Ugh.
So I'm glad I got my tweet on the record essentially putting out that theory right before I read the book, because that just confirmed what I was thinking.
Right, and that's archived for history. Wait, was that before the first? Because that's when the Library of Congress stopped archiving every publicly available tweet.
No, I didn't. Wait, they stopped archiving it all?
Yeah.
Why?
Because of the sheer amount of data it was probably taking.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'd say we both recommend reading the book. I don't think it's necessarily required reading if you're fairly up to date about the administration and its ineptitude.
It's not going to change your opinion about the administration one way or the other. Yeah, either you think Trump's a genius and he's going to continue to be a genius for his unorthodox style, or you think he's an idiot and his lack of organization is apparent and for its stupidity.
I do think there are some people out there who are a little bit on the fence, probably some kind of sort of never Trumpers at heart, but they voted for him, which there are a few of. And I'm hoping a few of them will read at least excerpts of this book or read the book itself and think to themselves, well, you know, this is worse than I thought it would be.
I mean, say what you will about his immorality, but the fact that he has a thing for sleeping with his friends' wives should concern people with any semblance of a moral compass.
And on that note, I think we should... Yep, no, he likes cucking them. Yep. Okay.
What am I going to be using my profile for? What am I going to be sharing? What do I want out of Twitter? So you want to set some goals.
Are you just generally confused about Twitter? What's a tweet?
Waste your life in a struggle for power. It's a very fast-moving social media platform, so you can post more than once a day.
I'm going to demystify Twitter. I know most of you have heard about Twitter, use Twitter, have definitely heard about hashtags. So today I'm going to explain all of that. Follow your friends, you can follow celebrities, you can follow pastors, you can follow banks, you can follow organizations, you can follow...
All right. Time for Twitterocracy. We haven't done this in a couple episodes. This past week, on Sunday, I was watching Meet the Press, as is a little tradition in this household. Every Sunday, we wake up, we have our coffee, we get into a brawl with the children over the TV, and then we turn on the news and try and keep them out of the room so we can actually pay attention. And I view Meet the Press as a forum for different sides to come to and a little bit talk it out. Chuck Todd interviews, and all the previous hosts interview Republican, Democratic senators, congressmen, White House officials. They usually have a fairly nice mix on their panel. One thing I've noticed is that there are rarely Trumpeters, if ever, Trumpeters on the media panel. Although there might be conservatives who, you know, will kind of say like a nice thing here or there.
They don't bring in Breitbart ever?
No. They don't have those crazy Stephen Miller or Jeffrey Lord or even like a Rick Santorum type who are just like, you know, stroking it to the president constantly. And, but they, you know, they have conservatives for sure. They have center right, center left, center, and some
occasionally Bernie.
Yeah, and some far left, either politicians or, you know, not far, far left, but a little bit, media types. And this past week, Chuck Todd interviewed Lindsey Graham, who's been a little bit of a newsworthy oddity recently for someone that went from calling President Trump a kook to golfing with him and saying how President Trump crushed him at golf and how he's so great at golf. And in the interview, Lindsey Graham generally comes off pretty personable. To be fair, he seems to have a sense of humor and he in the interview was kind of asked about his recent sort of change of heart about the president. His answer, I actually thought was, made a lot of sense and maybe even kind of newsworthy. We don't really need to get into it here, but if you read between the lines, there might be a little bit more going on there than meets the eye. Because he firmly defended the Mueller investigation while at the same time calling for an investigation into, I don't even remember, Fusion GPS, Hillary, Uranium One, who the fuck knows? Or is it an investigation into the I don't know. But either way, he was very adamant about defending the Mueller investigation. And so I'm on Twitter shortly after the episode. And someone retweeted a comment about – someone made about the Lindsey Graham interview. The original comment was not crushing Todd, but it pointed out something that Lindsey Graham said that was sort of a – mischievous political lie or whataboutism or something. The comment, there was a couple comments high up that were saying how, Chuck Todd never pushes back on people. He lets them lie. He's the worst. So I commented, well, he does sometimes push back. I think he asks pointed questions at times. I don't think he is the worst. And someone's like, he just let, you know, kept going, you know, he just lets people lie and, you know, he never pushes back. And so I said, well, who does push back? Like, which people out there do these put like real time fact checking pushbacks?
Sure. Name a name if you're going to throw them under the bus.
I wasn't implying someone doesn't exist. I just want to know who they thought did.
Right.
So someone, the first comment, and by the way, I'm still getting comments answering this with mostly just MSNBC hosts fucking I just get constant comments with MSNBC and CNN hosts. Like, one person said Anderson fucking Cooper.
Are you kidding me? I guess he's okay, but what the fuck?
Yeah, we could get into a whole other thing about how CNN has changed since Trump became president, and how they kind of get ratings off of this pushback, whereas they were a forum for Trumpeters before this, and still are, frankly.
Right. And then we could take it all the way back to Wolf Blitzer basically sponsoring the Iraq War. Man, I hate that guy.
And so I'm still getting it.
Dislike him.
He's not. Anyway, so I'm still getting answers on this. But the first one person said Joy Reid. Now, Joy Reid was actually on this Sunday's Meet the Press in their media panel. I don't have cable, which I got chided for on Twitter by saying that, but I don't have cable, so I don't really watch her show. I occasionally watch clips on YouTube, and I enjoy her when she is on Meet the Press, and she's on a fair amount. I agree with her point of view. She is somewhere on the left.
She's mostly on the left.
I know a lot of Bernie people don't like her. She went after Bernie, I guess, in 2016, but regardless, she's somewhere on the left. In general, I like her on Meet the Press. Don't know a ton about her. So, okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the one thing that, I guess, irks most of the Bernie crowd, is, at least me, speaking from my personal perspective, is that what annoys me most about her is her change from the Joy-Ann Reid who supported Barack Obama in 2008 to the Joy-Ann Reid who has an MSNBC show and all of this media attention. Because, I don't know, have you ever read that remark where she talks about Bernie's people ruining, like, being the person who stays over at your apartment and ruins your aesthetic? Yeah, she'll never live that one down.
I'm going to kind of tie in that a little bit in a second here. But that's an interesting take, because, okay. So, someone says Joy Reid. And so, I say, and this was more of a rhetorical question, which I also got pummeled on for asking a rhetorical question, which apparently the entire universe doesn't recognize as a rhetorical question. And I had to go so far as to looking up rhetorical question on Google and then screenshotting that and putting it in there and being like, no, I know what a rhetorical question is. Maybe you don't like, maybe you don't like my point, but, and so I asked the question, again, more rhetorically than looking for an answer, is, does she get GOP senators on her show? Implying that too much pushback against your guests will limit the number of and the variety of guests, especially the powerful variety of guests you get on there.
Right, the people want to listen to.
But not even just, I mean, yeah, AM Joy listeners don't want to hear from Lindsey Graham that much, but no. I meet the Press viewer does. I want to hear from Lindsey Graham at least once a week for 5 minutes. You know, that's it.
I mean, that's pretty generous. You can pretty much sum up that guy's opinions in about 45 seconds a week.
And he's not even, you know, it's, they usually have some member of the, in this case, the Republican White House or a powerful congressman or senator on, but then they also have on Democrats, of course. It's a fairly mixed bag there. And I think my point was that the only reason they get that mixed bag, which I do think serves a public good, you know, yeah, I don't want to give a platform for Republicans to just spout off bullshit constantly. That's Fox News. I don't watch that. But I do want to hear from them every now and then to know what's going on in their heads, because I don't know, they're senators in the majority, and so it kind of matters. I don't like it, but it matters, which is why I watch Meet the Press. And these people apparently don't watch Meet the Press, or they hate watch it. I don't know. Because they fucking hate Chuck Todd. Yeah, he's a hack. He's a tool. He lets everyone lie constantly.
I have a specific kind of criticism against him, but...
Go ahead.
Okay, so a few years ago, WISP Politics had their big end-of-the-year gala at the Orpheum Theater, which I had the fortune to be able to attend. And it was Chuck Todd in front of a room of, let's just say a lot of the elite power brokers in the state. He was described to them his take on, I think it was the 2016 election, But maybe it had been, I think this, I'm trying to remember, it was, I think the end of 2015, I think. Yeah, it was the end of 2015. It was a really warm December night.
So going right into the primaries.
Mm-hmm. And his take was so categorically wrong that I wish I had just spent the 45 minutes listening to some guy in a bar, for as informative as it was. But the fuck of it was is that Wispolitics, the organization that put it up, was spending a lot of money, and it kind of hurt them to have to put so much fucking money on a Chuck Todd appearance.
Yeah. And...
and it was just so wrong. He was like, I don't think Trump's going to get elected. It couldn't even possibly happen. And it's like, at that moment, I was like, well, you're obviously aren't speaking to anyone outside of your bubble, because that's absolutely happening.
Fair enough. And I by no means want to say that there are no criticisms of him. And I don't even want to say that there's no worthy criticisms of his interviewing style. He's not perfect, which I think I had to say at some point.
I kind of agree with that remark that he's a little too soft on his guests. I wouldn't say that he doesn't ask the tough questions. I would just say that he's playing excess journalism, like we were talking about in the other segment. He needs these people to come on so he can't fucking embarrass them.
Yes, but to me, first of all, that is what he's doing, which I think in a roundabout way everyone acknowledged. Criticizing me, but talking about this. But I don't think they appreciated that there has to be someone out there doing that. And maybe he's just, whether or not he knows he's doing it, wants to be doing it, thinks it's the best thing to do. I'm not even saying it's the best thing to do. Thank God not every journalist does that. But someone has to do it. And it's hard to find someone who's going to be too tough on their guests that can get a wide variety of guests. That's my only point, is that Joy Reid couldn't host Meet the Press, because she wouldn't, if she was...
she'd too, be seen as partisan.
Yes. And she wouldn't be getting on Mitch McConnell, Mike Lindsey Pence, Graham. Rex Tillerson, Lindsey Graham, whoever.
All right, whoever. Like, reach your hand into the Republican bucket and pull one out.
And while at the same time getting Diane Feinstein and Sherrod Brown and
Raul Gravaria from Arizona, or Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, or...
yeah, Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. Yeah. I was trying to think of a super progressive senator besides the obvious one, but...
and he gets them all because he allows them to not be called out on all bullshit constantly. They're politicians. They're all full of bullshit, which I don't think these people appreciate. You might agree with Bernie. I agree with Bernie. He has his share of bullshit. They all do. That's part of their job, is to have the right bullshit for their constituents and for who they're trying to reach. And for the issue that they're talking about at that time.
Yeah.
And he, yes, of course, he allows them to do this sometimes. But he does ask pointed questions. And anyway, I got fucking shit on like nothing else. This someone told me, because I asked when I, the first response to, well, does she get on GOP senators, was, you're on the internet. Why don't you Google it? Which has now gotten like thousands of upvotes against me. And which I said was condescending, which people told me was not condescending, which I disagree with, because it's
very... do people know what words mean?
Which is inherently... Hey, maybe I'm stupid and deserve to be condescended against, but then then you're arguing whether or not that's condescending. That's condescending. That's why everyone upvoted it. So they were condescending against the person they disagreed with, me.
It's a rhetorical question, people.
Oh, and then I got, that's not a rhetorical question because you're seeking information. Like, but I kind of wasn't, because I was right that she did. By the way, I then was like, you know what, maybe, and I even said this, I think, I'm like, maybe you're right. Maybe I should Google this. So I spent a while trying to find GOP senators who had been on her show. I got all types of responses like, well, she has Republicans. And I'm like, yeah, it's easy to get some dumb shit Republican, but I'm talking about a senator.
Then right, they said, somebody sitting in an office.
Oh, but then they said, well, she gets GOP legislatures. I'm like, yeah, but there's a difference between some Republican dipshit from Nebraska who's a congressman and a senator. Oh, well, she invites them on all the time, but they don't have the balls to come on. I'm like, which no, is not... my point?
Yeah.
That's – yes, of course they don't have the balls to come on. They're politicians who are afraid of being embarrassed. Duh. Right. Does Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown go on – Hannity? Yeah, I mean, we all think Hannity's, you know, a complete liar, but he would do that and, to his audience, make Bernie Sanders look bad. So Bernie Sanders isn't going on that show. And I don't want to get too, maybe he's tried to and Hannity doesn't. I don't know exactly.
We're not going to get into the weeds on that.
I just mean, in general, Democratic senators aren't going to go on to, Hannity or fucking bowtie Tucker Carlson on his show, and GOP senators aren't going on Joy Reid or Lawrence O'Donnell's show. And I think all of the above, but to a much, 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 much lesser extent, Hannity, serve a purpose. And I think Chuck Todd and a show like that, or maybe to some extent George Stephanopoulos,
that guy.
But, and yes, they're groan inducing at times. Totally get it. Yeah. I just think, and my broader point here is that I'm trying to just be a moderate on here. I'm just saying, hey, maybe he's not, like, quote, the worst.
I mean, and, John Hannity might have a claim to that title, people. Come on, have some context.
Yeah, right, that's what I'm saying. And the Twitterocracy. The liberal Twitterocracy in this case, just all over my ass, just all over me for just saying Chuck Todd isn't the worst and Joy Reid probably has a hard time getting GOP senators on.
Probably true.
Yes. Like, you can't be reasonable and honest on Twitter without getting crapped on. And by the way, if I went on to maybe Tucker Carlson's comment thread and said something similar about Chuck Todd, they'd all be on me too.
You think?
Oh, yeah. He's not a Republican, you know. Like, that's the thing. Like, everyone's like – the people in the center who are like kind of in the like weak centrist figures, which, yes, Chuck Todd probably is a weak centrist figure.
Oh, yeah.
Are not – are constantly crapped on by both sides of the spectrum for being, oh, Chuck Todd's just a mouthpiece for Republicans. Like, no, he's not. And he's not a mouthpiece for the liberals. He's just a dude asking, like, one hard question and a couple softballs for an hour a week. Now, I don't watch his cable show, but at least on Sunday mornings. And he lets people on his panel, by the way, you know, he doesn't so much challenge them, but they challenge each other, and you know, but respectfully. Oh, I love that. I love that they're not yelling at each other like an Anderson Cooper panel. I enjoy that. It makes me feel like warm and like okay with the world that this person can say this thing that frustrates me. Someone points out how that's wrong, but just nice and respectfully, and then they – you know, have maybe a short back and forth, but nothing too intense. It's not conflict TV. And God forbid we have an hour on a Sunday morning a week that's not just extreme purity tests. That's my only thing. So anyways, that's my story of yeah, man. Hey, this past week I also got retweeted by a relatively prominent tweeter. So that was cool. That made up for it. So
there is some value in Twitter.
Yeah, that felt good. The other big thing on Twitter just in the past, like, 24 hours is that the entire Democratic establishment apparently now wants Oprah to be president.
Man.
And it's just so disappoints me. It doesn't even infuriate me. It disappoints me.
Maybe they're just looking for anybody that has a built-in audience so that they don't have to worry about building their own bench. I mean, they could spend the next few years developing a policy platform and putting people in front of it so, you know, they could be in a better position to run for president in 2020, or they can just suck up to one of their biggest donors who already has a built-in audience and hope that she rides in on some kind of white horse to save them.
It's so sad how intimidated by Trump they are.
It's pathetic.
Like, go read the Michael Wolff book. You shouldn't be intimidated by him. You should be like, right. Wow, we have a great opportunity to unseat a sitting president. Nope. We need Oprah to run for us. By the way, Oprah seems smart, clearly charismatic. She doesn't have any demons that she hasn't been open about, you know, in a humanizing fashion. At least that we know of. But why? This cult of celebrity is going to be the downfall of the Republic. And I said this when Trump got nominated too, except at that time I was thinking it was going to be Zuckerberg or Mark fucking Cuban, and how it's going to, I was putting it more in terms of billionaires, which she is, but yeah, and then The Rock too is like toying around with running for president.
Stop it.
Who's fucking next? Triple H as vice president? Stop.
Get elected to something before you become president.
Yeah, like with Oprah. Why not run for Senate or governor first?
Chicago school board.
Yeah. Like really, we have to go from zero to president? Is that the message that we took away from Trump? Isn't it that you don't do that?
Well, they couldn't. I mean, I guess the consultant class put together their best argument against Trump and failed, so maybe they're, I don't even know anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's so weird. So, like, there was this huge complaint about, from the right, which there might have been some validity to, a little bit, that Obama didn't have the experience to be president. So they nominate someone next time, in 8 years, who has the least experience ever for a president.
Ever. And not even left, military experience.
And now the left is saying he doesn't have, or, you know, he didn't have enough experience, which definitely had validity to it. And so what's their response? Not someone with a lot of experience. Someone else with no experience.
Well, at least you could say the word policy to Oprah and her eyes wouldn't roll back into her head.
Yeah, and start going blah, 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 blah.
This is boring, Professor.
No, but I mean, I'm sorry. Do we really need Oprah determining, like, military strategy? Is she at all qualified for this? Is she at all qualified to get into the nuance of healthcare? I'm sure her heart is in the right place. Totally, I fine. But these are, lives are at stake. This is the presidency of the United States. And we're turning it into a Celebrity Apprentice. I mean, it's, oh my God, I cannot, that I guarantee you this is the downfall of the Republic. These idiots on Twitter start propping up celebrities.
Yeah, it's just this, like, petty authoritarianism, which is just getting worse. I mean, Bush, well, I mean, not Bush directly, but during his administration, certainly that's when Fox News became kind of the cult of the right.
Yeah.
And now it's just getting worse, where it's just getting even more petty and more authoritarian.
And liberals should not kid themselves that they are immune to this.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's not that they don't want, they don't want to get rid of the power. They just want to use it for their own ends.
Yep. I mean, don't tell anyone on Twitter this, but I didn't vote for Obama. Didn't vote for him twice. And I don't even stand by that, by the way. I kind of regret it, actually. It turned out fine enough, but two reasons I didn't vote for him. One, he wasn't liberal enough for me, which that's the part I've come to regret. is that, hey, you know what? Better him than Mitt Romney, I think. But the second part of why I didn't vote for Obama was the cult of Obama, and I do not regret resisting that.
Yeah, I never bought into that at all. I mean, especially after the 2007 NDAA vote in the Senate that he flipped on.
Which one is that?
That was the one that basically did the retroactive legalization so that AT&T and other people involved in the NSA's malfeasance weren't going to be prosecuted for it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, I'm not going to vote for this. No, I did vote for that.
Mm-hmm. Was he running for president at that time? Just about to. Yeah. You don't.
I'm sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have these kind of purity tests, but I can only judge people by their actions.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm fine. Like, so I saw an exchange on Twitter this morning that I think is a good sort of example of this. And I don't know exactly the conclusion these two individuals had, but they were going back and forth for like 20 tweets. And they're arguing about whether or not Hillary supports single-payer healthcare. Now, one guy was like, I've been studying healthcare for 15 years, and she was putting us on a path towards that. The other guy was like, yeah, but her actual policy and everything she said contradicts that, that she actually not only wants it to get to that point, but thinks it will get to that point. Right.
In sharp contrast to her statements as First Lady.
Oh, yeah, but that was a generation ago. People change.
Sure.
Except Bernie,
who was there.
Yeah, except Bernie. And so, now, not the original poster, but the person who started arguing with him saying, yeah, but Hillary, doesn't pass my test. Actually, they were talking, I think, about I think they were first talking about Oprah, and then the guy was like, no to all these celebrities, which is actually my point here, of course. And then he's like, how about all of these senators who have actual experience? And he brought up Kamala Harris, who I know you don't like that much. And this person commented, no, I don't like Kamala. And he's like, why? And he's like, well, I just don't like some of what she stands for. And this guy was like, yeah, but people said that about Hillary, too. And he's like, well, I didn't really like Hillary either because she wasn't for single payer. Now, I don't know how this guy voted in the 2016 election. I would argue that you have to compromise sometimes when the stakes are high. But that doesn't mean you have to also buy into the cult of that person, completely.
Right. In a two-party system, like voting for Hillary was basically a vote for acquiescence, not an endorsement.
Yes, you don't have to love the person you vote for, and you certainly don't have to agree with them 100%.
Yeah.
And this notion that the right, obviously, the right doesn't just resist this, have elements that resist it. They're totally willing to just back whoever 100%. They can go from criticizing Mitt Romney to being like, yes, but he's the only one. Same with Trump. All these Republicans claimed to hate Trump until he became the nominee. And then there's nothing wrong with him at all.
Right? They can go golfing together.
It's so ridiculous. Yeah. And so anyway, there's issues that as someone considers himself on the left, I really hate arguing with people on the left. And it's a problem. Like, you're going to start seeing this in the primaries coming up very soon.
Yeah, I don't think the Unity and Reform Commission did its job as well as they perhaps needed to. I mean, there are some structural improvements that are being discussed to the Democratic Party, but I don't think either side really ever stopped with the just vitriol in some cases.
Yeah, and how are they going to come out of the primaries? It's not so much right. The primaries can be very contentious. That's fine. Oh, that's really good. And that's right, good.
It's better.
Yeah, exactly. But how do they come out of it?
Right. Once, for instance, say, like, Sarah Smith in Washington wins despite the lack of help from the Democratic Party, are they going to embrace her if she gets into the general? And repeat that about a few hundred times across the entire country. That's what's shaping up in this primary season. Like, groups like Justice Democrats, Brand New Congress, all of them are standing up candidates who are outside of what would be called the Democratic mainstream.
And I can tell you what, Republicans, they will. They have their same, similar issues. They're not going to hesitate. They didn't hesitate, well, they hesitated on Roy Moore, but that's about it.
Right, they finally pulled his funding when he was at, when there was almost actual evidence of him committing a pedophile. So
then they gave it back.
Right, and then they gave it back.
And then the president endorsed him.
Got your morals right here, buddy.
I mean, at least they're sitting, their other senator, their senior senator from Alabama, said he wouldn't vote for him. But, whew, yeah, I don't know.
Again, it doesn't really matter what they say, only what they do and how they vote.
Well, it's been a lovely episode of Tell Me What to Think. We have a big week coming out. There's some breaking news that's come out in the course of our recording, which is Senator Feinstein of California unilaterally released the Senate Judiciary Committee testimony of Glenn Simpson from Fusion GPS. So I'm sure there'll be talk about that. President will continue to be stable.
Hopefully.
Like, stable and smart. There is, I haven't heard a ton of press about it, but there's big keeping the government open. Well, I suppose, I think that's what's been going on today, is all this DACA talk is about keeping the government open. Right. So senators are starting to feud about that today, and I'm sure that'll amp up.
What should be more public is the, well, hopefully there is some feuding, but the 702 reauthorization, that's also coming due.
Yep, that's all part of this as well. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that will be have bipartisan support.
Wide bipartisan support.
And probably not even discussed, even though there are people who on both sides who are at least want to talk about it, debate about it.
Various House committees put together certain reform packages. Like, I think the Judiciary Committee put together something. Well, actually, I know the Judiciary and Intelligence Committees in the House both put together packages, but I think the Judiciary has actually put some measure of reform into it to protect people's identities and privacy. But
which, I'd be nice if we could live in a political climate where we could have a mature discussion about this. Instead, we're probably going to have no discussion. Because it's just going to be bickering about important other things. But, yeah. That one's got enough, I think, of the leadership of both parties behind it that they're just going to keep going.
Oh, almost certainly. It just bothers me how much what they do with the 702 program, like the parallel construction and, yeah. Basically warrant free searching.
So what else is happening this week? Any big international things to look forward to or to dread and shiver in the middle of the night thinking about?
When Trump just announced he's going to Davos, the World Economic Forum, for the first time, so that's something.
Yeah, he gets to hang out with some billionaires.
I'm not even sure we've ever had a sitting president go to one.
Really?
Yeah. They always, I mean, obviously we send ambassadors. Like, I think John Kerry went when he was Secretary of State, but Obama wouldn't go.
Why wouldn't a president go? Is it not that important? Or is it some sort of bad PR? Or
it's purely PR is the problem. Like, it's not like a diplomatic forum where there's an agenda and people are going to be talking about things and things that they could do together. This is just a bunch of rich people talking about how they would like to make the world a better place and how they see the world, and people report on it. So there's very little concrete that comes out of it.
Huh. Wonder what his agenda there is. I think it's just, like I said before, it's just to have other rich people.
Yeah, that guy loves the fawning attention of billionaires.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, Xi Jinping did it last year, so.
Now, wasn't that sort of seen as a move of China grabbing some attention in the midst of the American chaos of 2017?
Right, they've been slowly trying to take more of a forceful presence on the international stage, especially in diplomatic forums.
Yeah. Like Paris Climate Accord.
It's easy to occupy a vacuum.
Yeah, we brought up earlier how the Koreans are talking, so that's good. It'll be a ramp up to the Olympics.
One thing I didn't realize is that the United States agreed to delay like one of their big winter exercises over there until after the Olympics, which is what allowed these conversations to take place anyway.
What do you mean it allowed them to?
Like, because the Koreans, or the North Koreans specifically, said that they would not have any conversation unless they canceled the exercise or delayed it.
Okay.
Because it was due to be going on basically before the Olympics, as I recall.
Seems like a pretty reasonable thing by the Americans. I'm sure the president was not consulted on that decision.
Yeah, that just goes to show you how much of the defense's decision-making is not left up to the White House, which is another scary thing to keep you up at night, I guess.
Yeah, Mattis and the Joint Chiefs, they're just like, why even bring this up to him?
Yeah, it's like, well,
he's not going to be happy we even asked him.
No, they always give him, I'm sure, judging from my personal experience, my interpretations of having to deal with people like this in power, is that they always frame the question and give him certain options, and then they control what the options are.
Well, isn't that a big part of what the National Security Council does? So their job is more to present options rather than advise on an option.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was just brought up in the Wolf book, talking about it. They actually had a little segment. I mean, we already did our Fire and Fury segment, sure, but whatever. They had a little bit in the book about, I believe it was the decision-making for Afghanistan, although it might have been the Syrian air launch. It was either the what to do about Afghanistan or what to do about Syria launching Assad launching those chemical weapons in the spring. And either way, the president was like waffling, didn't want to make a decision. He didn't like that he was being forced to make a decision. I guess at some point he said to, I don't even know if it was to Mattis, but he had someone tell Mattis, well, you just go ahead and, you know, sort of do what you want, or, you know, or I think you should go ahead and, you know, either fire the missiles or put more troops there or something. And Mattis is like, no, I need like an official in writing with a signature order from the president.
Right, because that's what you need for military action.
There must be
a legal paper trail.
Which I appreciate that the secretary is unwilling to go rogue, you know, or not even rogue, but I mean, you know, like not have a paper trail, you know, he wants it in writing in case there's any sort of, you know, oversight of this in the future or anyone looking at it or anyone questioning him. He is not going to be thrown under a bus.
Absolutely not.
That's one thing I've picked up from Mattis. Dude is not going to be, even with like the trans stuff, the so-called trans ban or whatever.
Yeah, he was hewing the middle corporate or the middle fucking Pentagon line. I mean, they've already started working on that and had been in the process of doing that since, well, at least for the last 3 years, right?
working on, like, doing, like, a study of it.
Well, I mean, they have the Department of Defense does not move with any alacrity. They have to study things in depth, come up with policy proposals. It's got to be discussed at the undersecretary level. Then they decide what the policy proposals are going to be, and then that gets kicked upstairs to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense and the coterie around that office. Yeah. And then eventually it gets to the point where they have to make legislation, so they'll draft something and hand it off to one of the senators that they like, or they'll run it through the White House. But a lot of the times it just requires the president's signature, like, yes, that will be defense policy.
I mean, it's probably good that they're not too crazy fast. At least it seems good in this time and place.
Yeah, well, when you move too quickly, inevitably some details get lost.
I think they brought up in the book that they brought this discussion about, like, the so-called... because it wasn't even a ban at that point. It's just, hey, what should we do about transgender people? Here are some of the things that the military has been kicking around. And McMaster, like, walked, or not McBob, I assume Mattis, I guess, would have walked out of the meeting, and, like, before anyone knew it, the president was tweeting about it. Like, that's, it just, he just, that's how he declared it. That's how he, it's just, they leave the meeting and he just grabs his phone and starts tweeting that.
Hey, I asshole, need something to talk about. Fucking, you can't govern by fucking proclamation. This isn't like the fourth fucking century.
Well, I mean, that's the you almost need, like, tea leaves to read into. I mean, that's one thing in the book, too, that they talk about is how a lot of the early policy in the White House was going back, looking at his rambling, improvised speeches, and trying to determine actual policy based off that.
I love the that discussion that the author describes where, who was it? The semi-competent deputy chief of staff.
Oh, Walsh?
Right, Katie Walsh, right. She goes to Jared and is like, what are three things the president cares about? Well, I think that's a conversation we should have. And it's like, dude, that conversation should have been had like 9 months ago, not 3 months after the inauguration. Fuck's sake.
Yeah, she seemed to be probably the most frustrated character in the book.
Can't blame her. I mean, if you have any degree of professional integrity or experience, I can't imagine that you would enjoy being in that kind of situation.
Well, apparently not. Yeah, none of them did. And the only one who does has dementia and narcissism.
Wait, is that Trump?
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, Bannon? No, he's not demented.
Yeah, I think it seems like Congress will take center stage, but if that keeps going on for too many minutes, then the president this week will sure find something to grab some headlines, as is a common refrain.
Right.
I have a hope, though, that what's going on in the Senate, because this is an important discussion. There's lives at stake. Sort of related to the DACA thing, the Homeland Security just announced that they are rescinding the visas of like 200,000 El Salvadorians.
Right. They're temporary protected status.
They were I don't know if they were farmers. I think they said in the NPR report I heard that they were farmers, most of them. But anyways, there are a number of people who came from El Salvador in under HW. There was a earthquake there.
I think it was W. It was the 2000s, wasn't it?
It might have been, because I think they did say 17 years. So mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be right. It would have been W. And they said that the the conditions in El Salvador are now better. So Everything's fine. Go back home.
It's not. It just because it became the murder capital of the world in that time doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but at least there's no cracks in the ground from the earthquake anymore. I don't even know. Everything was rebuilt, I guess, is their logic. I'm not sure. 200,000, though.
Yeah, it's. Oof. What bothers me about the whole reauthorization argument, and it's like, oh, we're going to hold out for DACA, like, that should be the brass ring. It's like, what about the CHIP funds and the Community Health Center funds? Is that just going to get left aside? Are we going to leave, like, hundreds of thousands of people without health care? I mean, admittedly, those 800,000 people in DACA need to be protected, but...
Well,
it's frustrating. Trump is manufacturing this argument, so the liberals have to select which portions of their agenda they are willing to sacrifice, which is just atrocious to me that they're letting him do it.
Yeah, the sort of back to the book again. They bring up how to Trump, anyone else's win is his loss, and he will not accept that. And so he's fabricating DACA and CHIP into being, if they occur, wins for Democrats. Whereas he himself and other Republicans have expressed interest, have expressed support for these things. Like, are they even wins for the Democrats if they happen? Why is that not? Why aren't they just bipartisan things? Like, why does this even have to be a debate? It's a totally manufactured showdown.
Absolutely.
That shouldn't even exist.
Like, millions of people's lives in the balance.
And for what? Just so the president can have a fight with congressional Democrats?
Yeah, that's exactly
who are in the minority?
And the Republicans are willing to go along with it.
Is it because they're heartless and don't want CHIP and DACA, or at least their leadership is? Like, I'm kind of confused on this.
I mean, just think, if they got, like, just 49% of the Republicans on board, like, just enough to override a veto, you know, they could pass something and wouldn't even need the president's signature on it.
And something just really simple, relatively cheap, and humanitarian like CHIP and DACA. Those are not even huge programs.
They're not controversial.
And they're not... Yeah, oh God. Yeah.
The controversial part should be the fact that we're arguing about it.
Yes. Well, hey, you heard it here first, people. We shouldn't be fucking arguing about these things. They're unfortunately, you had to hear it first. This shouldn't be breaking. It's mind-boggling that...
I love the intellectually fascinating descent into fascism.
Go on.
Oh, I mean, now that we're talking about, like, which parts of the liberal platform are going to be axed, and the Republicans aren't going to gain anything. Like, they may even gain parts of their platform, but not even the parts of it that they necessarily want. Or would help their electoral chances in 2018. Like, because they got a tax cut, which in about 6 months is going to prove to be wildly unpopular.
Well, and is going to make if they want to do anything that involves spending, like infrastructure, which could have been a nice, easy bipartisan thing if it just would have been done in the first place. Instead, president had to be crazy for a year, and they have to increase the deficit and do this crazy tax bill. So now, how the fuck are they gonna? And he wants $18 billion or whatever it is for the stupid wall. On top of that,
right? He's holding those people's health care, their chance to live in the life that they've come to enjoy, like at hostage.
I mean,
at gunpoint.
The wall is actually probably the best evidence against my theory that McConnell and Ryan are controlling policy, because they were adamant for a long time the wall is stupid, both of them.
Right. There's no reason. It's just such a disaster on so many levels.
You know, I could see this $18 billion not necessarily going to fencing or a wall. I could see it being written kind of loosely that it goes to just Homeland Security or Border Patrol or, you know,
more
various...
technology. Technology is a really easy thing to spend money on, because whether or not it works, the money is spent.
Yeah, and it would go towards some sort of anti-immigration border security thing, but it wouldn't go towards a big, beautiful wall.
No, I'm almost sure there's never going to be a wall.
But Trump can say, we're going to build it, we got the money for it. And right. By the time anyone realizes that there's no goddamn wall, he'll at least be you know, hopefully impeached, but you know, he won't be needing the votes or to continue that lie.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out a point that you just brought up. Like, imagine if Trump's first action instead of healthcare was infrastructure, literally building a bridge. What a different tone that would set.
It's idiotic that was not that it. Maybe he talked about it so much too that it's just so stupid. Hey, that's one thing we can jump on someone like Bannon for.
Oh yeah,
such a genius. Allegedly. But he had this. But he had this warlike mentality, so he didn't want to do anything that would have been a bipartisan piece of legislation. The rest of the staff was so inept that they couldn't get their act together to start pushing something bipartisan, even if they would have wanted to.
Right.
And the president has such, you know, attention deficit disorder that he forgot about it for a few months until he needed to say something for people to like him. So, yeah.
Right, and that's no balance for Bannon's just pure contempt for the state.
Yeah, he wouldn't have wanted to. He's not so much an austerity, like, spending person, but he doesn't want to create more bureaucracy at the very
least. He's more like an anarchist.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess if you're a unified field theory guy, it's really easy to be an anarchist because you don't necessarily appreciate the value and role of the influence of the state on society and vice versa.
Yeah, part of me wants to say, oh, he's really complicated and has conflicting notions. There should be a book about him. But fuck that. I don't need to give more time of day to it. I already just did give enough time of day to it. He's a marginal figure.
Increasingly marginalized.
Yeah. Hopefully he has enough kick left in him to hit the president at some point in the next year or two. But beyond that, he's done for.
I mean, even if he stays in Breitbart, which is looking increasingly unlikely.
He's lasted the weekend.
What does he do when Breitbart tells him to kick her to get out of their house? Do you think this is splitting the Mercers?
No.
Right, because it's all Rebecca. He basically washed his hands of the whole thing and gave it to her.
Yes. Granted, he's still rich, and I guess it's possible for him to disagree with her, but I think as long as she is putting money towards anything moderately racist and xenophobic, he'll be fine. That's the impression I get of him. He's not going to get into the weeds about specifics.
No. I can't. Maybe she's investigating options, because, I mean, I think Bannon owns a part of it, so it might be difficult to kick him out. She might not have the votes, so to speak.
Yeah, I'll be happy to not be concerned about who's running fucking Breitbart someday.
Right? As much as I really hope for one day I don't have to care what a billionaire thinks.
Oh, we might have to keep ourselves alive a while for that.
Maybe move out of Beloit. Okay, so I just want to say one last thing.
Go ahead.
These resistance tactics. I saw the guy that, like, at Funder, who's been basically profiting off of the resistance, and it makes me realize that things that I was thinking initially just maybe weren't said loud enough or repeated enough. Like, the resistance isn't giving money to some national organization. If you really want to resist Trump and everything that he's doing to this country, you need to find a way to get involved locally. Like, volunteer at a food bank, volunteer at the hospital, but just connect with members in your community and show them that it is better to cooperate with each other than calling each other names on Twitter and hating the entire world.
Yeah. Yeah. And giving money to, you know,
people that are just pocketing it.
Yeah, like a nebulous large national organization that can easily be co-opted or backdoor shenanigans. Not that they're all bad by any means, but
just be super careful.
It can be. But you know what's never going to be bad? Yeah, volunteering at the soup kitchen. That can't be co-opted.
Right? And you're still feeding poor people.
You know, being involved in your local school board. Yeah, that can't be co-opted.
And if you want to give money to a candidate, make sure you read up on them first.
Yep. All right. Well, that's been Tell Me What to Think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can reach me at, I'll get to you, at, on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. He's Charles Minnick. You can reach him on Twitter at green_weird, which is WYRD. Thank you. Have fun. Be good. Put your guns down and put your minds at ease so we can work towards a common goal of peace. Some days it's sunny, some days it rains. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!